Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Plastic Podcast, the show that tells the story of the past, the present, and the future of our relationship with plastic. And today we are serving science and turtles. Okay, so yes, this is a show about plastic. It's in the name. I came up with the name. I get it. Today, we are going to be talking a lot about sea turtles. Now, if you're upset about that, take a deep breath, chill out a bit. You're going to be fine. You're going to like it. And you'll even get some fun facts. In fact, you'll get a couple along the way. But if you stick around to the end of the credits, you will get an extra special one.
So give me some fin. Noggin.
Dude. Now, the show today is not all about sea turtles. There is a link. Turtles are perhaps the largest animal symbol of the anti-plastic movement. It all started around 10 years ago in 2015 when a viral video found its way to the internet of a scientist pulling a plastic straw out of a turtle's nose. Maybe you've seen it. After this video came out, restaurants all over the world stopped giving out straws or switched them out for those paper versions that used to get all soggy, but they have gotten better over time. Now, the scientist who took this video is a self-proclaimed sea turtle biologist named Dr. Christine Figner. And guess what? You won't believe it. That is our guest for today's episode. Dr. Christine Figner does research on turtle migrations and their trophic morphology. Breaking that down, trophic means like food or eating, and morphology refers to the shape, the size, or the design of physical features. And we'll also throw in the word optimal in there, which means the best for fitness or survival. So trophic morphology is how our bodies are designed to help us eat. Boom. Science communication, baby. An example of my trophic morphology would be how I need a big enough mouth to fit 18 donut holes inside, which is most optimal for my survival of any given day. Now, Dr. Figner is currently living and researching in Costa Rica, and she was kind enough to hop on a phone call with me and talk all about her work. We spoke about how her passion for sea turtles evolved and the threats that modern plastics pose to the ancient creatures. We talked about the video she published and the response it generated, now able to reflect on the movement 10 years later. And we also talked about how to navigate both spaces of science and activism together. I hope you enjoy our chat, and I'll see you on the other side of the East Australian Current.
You're riding it, dude! Check it out!
All right, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. I'm very excited to have you. Can you please introduce yourself?
Well, yeah, thank you, first of all, for having me on this show. I'm Dr. Christine Figner, and I'm a marine conservation biologist by trade, and my focus are sea turtles.
Okay, amazing. So I talk to a lot of scientists, and I'm always curious to ask when their interest began. So I guess in your case, sea turtles. When did you start to become interested in sea turtles and decide you wanted to study them?
Yeah, so my journey into marine biology actually started, at least the passion started, as a child. So I went on vacation with my parents, mainly to the ocean, because my parents are more of ocean people than mountain people, I guess. It just instilled in me in this curiosity for the underwater world and what's going on there. And when I got my first diving goggles, that pretty much opened up a whole new world. And so friends say that I, even kindergarten, already said that I would become an ocean explorer, just like Jacques Cousteau and Hans Hess, which were, you know, big back then, having, you know, incredible underwater documentaries that I could see in the television as well. And so I knew that at one point, of course, I needed to study biology to become what I call an underwater explorer. I also decided to do my internship, which was mandatory back then, in a zoological setting, where in an aquarium, actually, where I could get, like, you know, firsthand experiences with scientists researching marine life. And I think that was very, very helpful, first of all, to kind of in of what scientific work could look like. And also, I think giving you a realistic idea of what that work, especially field work, would entail.
Oh my gosh, I would love to do an internship at an aquarium if I had literally any skills that they would find useful. I know I'm too old to do any of those entry level programs for young people. I checked. But if you are in high school listening to this, now is your time to get in touch with your local aquarium because they might have something for you.
And then the other thing was that while I was working there, a lot of the biology students I saw struggling with the English language because the scientific language nowadays is English. And of course, I'm German, so I'm not a native speaker. So I did not want to, you know, be bogged down by the fact that I wouldn't be able to speak English well enough. And I actually did an exchange here in the US to kind of brush up on my English.
Okay, huge shout out to anyone who has ever studied or done anything at all in a language that is not their first. That is not easy.
And so, you know, when I kind of started to develop my passion, sea turtles were actually not even on my radar, I have to admit. It was back then humpback whales. Humpback whales really fascinated me because of the songs. Family is quite musical, so there was always music around. Just thinking about that another species other than humans might have something like such as a song that is not just, you know, stationary, but that develops over the course of their life, that adds parts depending on the experiences and all of that. So I actually set out studying biology to study humpback whales. So I did my master's in that. I went to Costa Rica for an internship to just, you know, get some field experience. And I ended up in a leatherback turtle project here in Costa Rica. And that was really where my sea turtle journey truly started. And while I was in this project, of course, you are getting like the whole spiel about, you know, sea turtles in general, sea turtle biology. And of course, you're also realizing that this animal that has been on this planet for such a long time, all of a sudden is on the brink of extinction, and it's all thanks to us humans. And it gives you a big feeling of guilt because, of course, I am a representative of the human species. And it made me incredibly sad thinking that in my lifetime, there's a very real chance that those animals will not be here anymore. I mean, leatherbacks have been around estimatedly for about 110 to 90 million years. So they literally have survived the extinction of the dinosaurs. And I think this is really what started it all. And also my university that, you know, at least when I asked for it, gave me the opportunity to do my master's thesis in Costa Rica with leatherbacks. And then I just moved to Costa Rica full time. And I'm still here. In between, I did also a PhD. Like after I worked a little bit here, I actually went back to school and did a thesis on the migration patterns of olive ridleys and their dietary preferences. And so now I'm Dr. Christine Figener.
Wow, that is quite a journey. And I can hear the passion in your voice just when you talk about these animals and you tell that story. And I didn't think about how long sea turtles have been on this planet, as opposed to how recent the threats that they're facing have been around. I guess the reason that they might not make it through this second mass extinction in their species' lifetime is because of us humans. But let's get into why that might happen. Maybe we'll start with a video that you posted in 2015 that went viral on the internet. You probably know the one I'm talking about. And our listeners, if you haven't seen it, you can find it in the episode description. But can you tell us a little bit about that video?
Yeah, so the video you're speaking of is very likely the video of the turtle that had a straw stuck in its nose. And it was filmed during my data collection, actually, for my PhD thesis or dissertation in 2015, when we were out sampling on a boat. And during that time, because, of course, fieldwork is always, you know, a little bit costly, a researcher actually piggybacked onto my research because he was interested in the critters that are living on sea turtles. And so we had been collecting for him pretty much everything that kind of like on turtles, let it be some crustaceans, a little crabs or a little sanguillos. But yeah, so that particular day he was on the boat as well. And after I was done with my data collection, he said, you know, I think she has something funny in the nose. It looks like a big barnacle. And since I wasn't doing anything anymore, I just grabbed my camera and said, oh, that's kind of funny. That's an uncomfortable place to have a barnacle stuck. So I started filming, and, you know, when he started pulling, it was very slowly materializing that it had a strange shape for a barnacle. It became, you know, longer and longer. And after a while, I could see black stripes on it, and we were really not sure what it was. And so we cut off a piece. One of my local assistants actually bit on it and said, that's plastic. And from that point on, it was pretty clear. I mean, the shape already looked like it, but it was a straw. Well, we removed it. the turtle was probably not so pleased about it in that minute, but very happy when he swam away. And after that, I uploaded it to YouTube and it just went crazy. I mean, it was never the intention. It was never what we thought would happen. It was just, we were so shocked about it. I think we all felt incredibly guilty as well, again, because straws are human made.
Yeah, so as I said, for anyone who hasn't seen it, you can find a link in the episode description, but it's quite, maybe heart-wrenching is a good word for the video. And it was massively impactful. I think after this came out, both the sea turtle and the straw both became symbols in their own right. Sea turtle representing almost all of the vulnerabilities that the ocean is facing, and straws representing all of the problems with plastic pollution. And I guess it kind of speaks to the power of the media, because not all of us live near the ocean or interact with sea turtles all that often, if ever, even.
And so, yeah, when we, you know, published it, it became this like internet sensation. Everybody suffered with the turtle, and it definitely made sea turtles the poster child, I would say, for the impact that plastic has, at least in the marine environment. And I think this is rightfully so. Of course, there are so many other animals, including massive whales, that are impacted by plastic, by eating plastic or ingesting plastic. But I think sea turtles were one of the first species that have been found to have ingested plastic. In fact, the leatherback turtle has been the very first species ever found to have had plastic in their stomach. So those records date back to the 60s and 70s. The actual first published scientific paper on it was from the 80s, but it was, you know, also leaning on data that was collected before from necropsies. Pretty much with the, you know, the introduction of plastic right after Second World War, when it was became really big.
Okay, so then it's like almost 80 years ago since, at least, since these species started interacting with plastic. I'm wondering, obviously no sea turtle will enjoy having a straw in its nose or plastic in its stomach, but can we break down specifically all the harms that plastic is posing to species like sea turtles?
Nowadays, we estimate that about 80% of all the sea turtles swimming in our oceans do have plastic in their stomachs. So that's a lot. And, you know, it doesn't always lead to the immediate death of a turtle. You know, it can lead to, for example, perforations, to any kind of wounds within the digestive tract, but it can also completely block it. So that means the turtle can starve while it has a stomach full of plastic because it can't eat anymore. But the problem with plastic, especially plastic that swims for a long time in the ocean, is that it almost works like a sponge. It attracts certain toxins to its surface. And so there have been studies that show that just, you know, the consumption of about 14 pieces of plastic already reduces the mortality, or like the probability of, what it raises the probability of mortality by 50%. And we're only scratching the surface, because it's really difficult for a species that is so long lived of how, you know, consumption really affects the entire life cycle. So yeah, that's kind of the problem. And that's not even including the entanglements of plastic, right? Because if you think about industrial fishing and all of that, what are those nets made of? Of course, it's plastic.
Would you say then that plastic is the main threat to turtles at the moment?
I get this question so many times, and I find it really, really difficult and also wrong to do a ranking of threats, because unfortunately, plastic is a threat that sea turtles are facing. One of the major threats, I would say, as well. But if it's the most, you know, dangerous part of their lives, I don't think so. It depends maybe on the population, because there is so much other stuff going on in our oceans. There's industrial fisheries that kill hundreds of thousands of sea turtles. But then we also have the climate crisis. So we have temperatures that are rising within the water. We have the ocean level that is rising, which is destroying, or like literally, yeah, eroding our nesting beaches, temperatures globally that are rising, and also the sand temperatures. And because the biological sex of a sea turtle depends on the temperature during the incubation of the eggs in the sand, we already have a problem with feminizations of populations. So plastic is one of those problems, and they're all somehow interconnected. Like I said already, you know, what are fishing nets made of? It's plastic. And why do we have the climate crisis? Because we are using way too many fossil fuels. And what is plastic made of? It's petroleum, right? So this is all this like vicious cycle. They're all interconnected. And I think the common denominator is us humans, right? I think that we should have very clear. It's humans and it's our lifestyles. So the way how we eat, the way how we, you know, move about in the world and how we consume. That's the sad truth.
Yeah, these are all so interwoven, I guess, when we really look at it. And I like the idea that it's not the best approach, perhaps, to try and rank them. We know that they're all issues on their own, and perhaps even trying to rank them or identify the worst one could take away our focus from the others. So they're all things we need to be working on in tandem. But despite the reality of the interconnectedness of all of these threats, turtles and straws have gotten quite a lot of airtime comparatively. Do you have any thoughts on why these two became such large symbols?
Well, I can only guess, right? So this is nothing hard sustained fact here. I mean, I think the video definitely had something to do. It's because, you know, well, sea turtles are charismatic megafauna, which means we do emotionally relate to sea turtles. Like, we think they're cute, maybe not cuddly because they're not fluffy, but they definitely, you know, kind of totally have sympathies from our sides, just as like panda bears and cute animals, baby animals especially. And I think seeing such an animal in such a, you know, horrible position as in that video, and it's a close-up of the face and you could see the suffering, I think it does something to us emotionally. And after that, even though plastic straws are definitely not the most, or like the biggest part of the plastic, not even the single-use plastic, but it symbolizes the problem with single-use, right?
For anyone who didn't listen to our episode on the history of plastic, you can go back and find it, but there we learned that plastic products in the early stages were really meant to last a long time and for people to use them again and again. The concept of single-use didn't come around until much after plastic was invented. At some point, we started using plastic for just things that we don't need. So I think that the straw represents both single-use plastic and unnecessary single-use plastic. I know some people do need to use straws, but most of us really don't. But as someone who's out there in the field year after year, have you seen any change in the last decade or so since this movement started? I mean, I know straws alone have got to be less than like 0.1% of plastic waste, less than that even. But, you know, perhaps it is the greatest example of success we do have for collective action. So even if that's the only effect it has had, maybe that's worth something in its own. But I'm curious, in the field, have you noticed any impacts of this movement 10 years later?
Yeah, well, I don't want to be totally negative about it. Honestly, I think because it opened up the discussion. If you think about it, like, you know, 10 years back, nobody was even talking about plastic. Nobody cared about plastic. And now we're actually at a point, I think every child knows that plastic is bad for the environment, especially for turtles. We're having more and more research that even show that plastic is really, really not healthy for us humans neither. You know, if you look around and if you see all the companies and all the countries, especially the, you know, the policies that now exist to phase out straws, they usually didn't come as only phasing out straws. Most of them actually started phasing out other single-use plastics at the same time. If you look at the, you know, the EU, for example, or even here in Costa Rica, the plastic was just, you know, the starter. And then people were like, you know what, if we start with straws, we can also talk about styrofoam and other things. So it didn't exist in a vacuum, right? It came with a lot of other changes. And now we're even discussing a UN treaty, right? And it actually doesn't only talk about the management of the waste, but it also talks about how can we reduce the production of plastic. And I want to make that very clear. So we will not recycle our way out of this crisis. And we do have to get the producers responsible, right? And I always say, because when I talk to them and they say, oh, it's not as easy and we don't have any comparable materials, I'm always thinking and sometimes saying, you know, we're almost flying to Mars to colonize Mars and invent new technologies almost every day for that. So really, you want to tell me that we're not able to invent something that could replace plastic but is a lot healthier?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I mean, there are people out there trying to find solutions for alternative plastics. We haven't quite cracked the code on them yet, you know, to make them the ideal solution. But I mean, at the same time, there's people preparing to go to Mars right now for funsies. So it's a question of priorities. One thing I want to explore on this podcast is the intersection of scientific research and activism. And I know that you've existed in both spaces for a while. And I'm wondering if you can speak to your experience about taking on these two roles at once. You also wrote an article, and there's something I want to ask about. It was titled, "What I Learned Pulling a Straw Out of a Turtle's Nose." And there's a quote you said, "Talking to non-scientists is uncomfortable and effective." Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so maybe first your first question. So I think I have now existed for longer in this space than maybe when I wrote this article or even when I started out. And I have to say, I was very slow in leaving my ivory tower as a scientist, or even I would say more my jungle here, because, you know, I'm very isolated from the world, sometimes just doing my thing. And this video kind of was like the moment where I realized how powerful social media is for once. You know, I can sit here in my little home in the jungle and literally publish things that are read, you know, in I don't know how many countries, by how many people, that I can educate, that I can, you know, let people know of what their part could be in the whole story. I also realized that as a scientist, we do have a responsibility, I think, which I think the scientific community is slowly awakening to. I think it is not enough anymore that we are just the, you know, the neutral bystanders that collect data and analyze the data and interpret the data. And I think it's our responsibility to communicate to non-scientists, because a lot of times the information comes from politicians who are not scientists and who twist and turn everything. And I think it's on us to really make sure that information is put out there that is understandable for everyone. It's just a different way of communicating, right? So that is what makes me uncomfortable, because a lot of times when you're trying to simplify a very complex topic, it introduces inaccuracies, which of course in science you try to avoid usually. And so you have to find a way of doing it and maybe keeping the inaccuracies to a limit or to a minimum, and also being comfortable with, you know, kind of being not as clear or maybe not as scientific correct sometimes of how you say things, right? Because you're getting drilled when you write a scientific article. Every word has a definition almost, and you know, it is very much matters of how many numbers and after the comma are there and how you say certain things. So all of those rules kind of don't apply as much for the communication, because there you're trying to be as clear as possible and as simple as it needs to be. And I think it was actually Carl Sagan that said that, you know, if you can explain it to a child, then you do really understand it yourself, the topic, and then, you know, you know you're on the right way. You know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I mean, I'm always calling myself an accidental storyteller, because that's how I started out. You know, this video just kind of pushed me into that direction, and I could have not done it, I guess, just, you know, let it be and keep on doing what I've been doing before. But it comes with a certain guilt as well, because you feel like your subjects, your sea turtles, do not have a voice, right? So they just live their lives and populations are dwindling and you are watching it as a scientist. And again, you feel like you should be doing something, right? So you should be somehow communicating this and giving the voice to the voiceless, your voice to the voiceless.
Well, I thank you for taking the effort to do that. And I know the sea turtles do as well. And it's interesting that those sort of the scientific publications and then like mass media are two entirely different skill sets. You've been doing it now for a long time, but I'm sure a lot of scientists sort of navigate that in their own ways and in their own time, but it is necessary and we appreciate it. Thank you for it. You wrote a book, I'm going to try and pronounce it, Meine Reise mit den Meeres Schildkröten. Did I do it? Okay. That's German for My Life as Sea Turtles. And that's available now, but in the event that you don't read German, I read that the English version is going to be released in May. Do you want to tell us anything about this book?
Yeah, so my book, Meine Reise mit den Meeresschildkröten, actually translates like literally to My Journey with Sea Turtles, but it didn't sound as pretty in English, so it became My Life with Sea Turtles. It's very dear to my heart because it is a book, of course, about the sea turtles, but I didn't want to just package fun facts about sea turtles, well, fun, maybe more or less fun, into, you know, a popular science book. That's kind of the genre that it belongs to, because I honestly don't like reading it very much most of the times, because it can be still pretty dry. And one of my big heroes, I'm not going to lie, is Dr. Jane Goodall. And I absolutely loved her books as a child because she managed to disseminate information about chimpanzees, about the threats chimpanzees are facing in such a emotional and very well-written way that always intermingled with her own story as well. And so I took that as an example. I'm not saying it became, you know, the same, right? I mean, Dr. Jane Goodall writes, I mean, it's absolutely, yeah, incredible. Writes very eloquent and very well. But I tried to emulate that a little bit. And yeah, I pretty much tell my story a little bit about how I became a sea turtle biologist and intertwine it with the life cycle of a sea turtle and going through the different stages of how a sea turtle pretty much, you know, hatches, becomes adult and all of that. And maybe also some insights into conservation and marine conservation, especially because I have come to realize that a lot of people do not even know first thing about conservation work and the realities of it. Let it be, you know, the type of life you're living, if you're really completely dedicated to conservation, the constant struggles of also as a woman in conservation, of working in a country that is maybe not your native country, of how you acquire funds and all of that. The neocolonistical ideas that conservation still has in a lot of parts of the world. So all of that I try to pretty much put into this book. Some people describe it as like it's a mixture of autobiography, adventure, and a popular science book. So I think that's a pretty good summary. I hope it will encourage young people, especially women, to maybe follow my footsteps. Of course, hope. That's, of course, the big, 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 big bottom line, that people just fall a little bit in love with sea turtles and think about the ways they themselves can make a difference and help to, yeah, guarantee a future for these animals on our planet.
Wow, you are really selling it. I do not read German, but I cannot wait until I can get my hands on this English copy. I will put a link in the description for people to pre-order. We are going to start wrapping up. So we've heard a lot of them already. But I will ask, is there any one last fun fact you'd like to share with us about turtles? And if you have a favorite turtle?
Well, of course, my favorite turtles are leatherbacks. I think they're like the unicorns, like the last unicorns. But some people don't even know what they look like. If I would ask them, hey, draw me a leatherback, they would have no idea of how to do it. So maybe unicorns are even more known than leatherbacks then, thinking of it. Fun fact about sea turtles, I think there's so many. I think fun is, for example, that they have some type of kidneys in their head. So you have to think about, as an animal that lives mainly in a salty environment, you are consistently losing fresh water to your environment, right? So you would shrivel up like a raisin if you wouldn't have somehow a way of counterbalancing that, right? How you can pretty much acquire fresh water over and over again. And so sea turtles do that by having these kidney type glands in the head and modified tear ducts. And so they consistently filter excess salt from their system and then excrete it over their eyes. So they literally consistently crying, which you don't really see underwater. But when you see them, for example, on the beach nesting, it looks like, you know, they're constantly crying. And that has led to a lot of misinterpretation about like, ooh, the female is in so much pain. It's not. It's just literally an essential survival tool that you can live in the ocean as an animal that has, you know, that needs to have fresh water in their body, of course.
That's kind of beautiful, actually, if not poetic. The next question is, what is your favorite part of your job?
Oh, you know, I think what has always provided me the magic is that I get to work in a very incredible environment. I mean, you can't see it, but just looking out of my window, I'm literally looking at a tropical rainforest. I can go onto the beach. I get to see incredible night skies. And of course, I can work with a wild animal very, very, very close up. I don't think there's a lot of species that permit you to be that close without having to, you know, sedate them or anything else. And you can just share those precious moments, you know, when the females, for example, come up to nest. I think that is very unique to working with sea turtles.
Okay, I hope anyone who has even the slightest interest in science was listening to that, because this could be your life, people. That sounds pretty cool. Lastly, is there anything that we did not discuss today that you would like to share with the audience?
Yeah, I think, you know, just like read something about sea turtles, get excited about something. Honestly, there's so many things in this world that are not going well. Just become part of the solution. Just don't be the innocent bystander that just doesn't care or is ignorant about certain things. I think that is important. You know, we all can chip in. And if everybody would give their two little parts of grains, I think we could make a huge difference.
All right, I think that is a wonderful note to end on. I want to thank you so much for your time and for teaching us about sea turtles and for sharing your work. Last question. Where can people find you? Where can people follow your work?
Yeah, you're very welcome. And if you would like to learn more about, you can always follow me on Instagram at seaturtlebiologist. That's my handle. Or also my website is seaturtlebiologist.com. Pretty easy to remember, I think.
Okay, perfect. There will be lots of links in this episode description for everyone to check all of this stuff out. And thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
All right, everyone. We made it through that East Australian current, and we are now approaching the Sydney Harbour to seek the help of a pelican friend. Now, back on topic. Turtles and straws might seem like a cliche on a podcast about plastic pollution. I might be more inclined to agree with that if turtles were actually in a better spot now because of it. I don't want to end this on a low note, but while there are more paper straws out there in the world, there's also more plastic in the ocean now than there was 10 years ago. And there's other things than just straws that can get stuck inside a turtle's nose. So I think it's important to remember the turtles and the straws, if only to remind ourselves that we are capable of making collective changes. And we can use this power we have and apply it to more than just the straws. And I think we are, slowly. More and more people are becoming aware about plastic waste and paying attention to plastic products around us and whether or not we actually need them. And I think that's the takeaway for today. You've been listening to Plastic Podcast. You can find more information about this week's guest and links to their work in the episode description. Join us back here in 1 week's time, when we're going to talk to Dr. Yvonne Chashua, an expert in chemistry and museum studies, about her work preserving plastic artifacts of great cultural significance and how her work can inform environmental approaches to plastic pollution. Cover art for the show was done by Laurel Wong, and the music you're listening to was done by Tadeo Cabejos. I am your host, Clark Marchese, and this episode was produced, written, and engineered by me. If you loved it, I will not only see you here next week, but I would really appreciate a 5-star rating across platforms and a review on Apple Podcasts. I think I'm going to start reading one review per week at the end of the episode, and we're only on episode 6, so chances are high that yours will be chosen. Plastic Podcast is a part of a larger network of sciencey podcasts called Pine Forest Media. You can find more information about them in the episode description or the website at pineforestpods.com and Instagram at pineforestmedia. We've got some exciting science podcasts coming out this year, and that review I was talking about really helps the entire network to grow. All right, thank you to all of you who have made it this far. And as promised, I have one last fun fact about turtles.
For those that are not familiar with sea turtles, we have 7 worldwide, and the largest species is the leatherback turtle, which, you know, on average has a carapace length, like a shell length, of about 1.50 meters. With head and tail, it's actually as tall as I am, so 1.70 meters about, but weighs, you know, close to 0.5 tons or even more. So it's an impressive animal. And it also looks a little bit different than all the other sea turtle species because it does not have a hard shell, but it has actually kind of a soft shell, hence the name leatherback. And they have been around for millions of years, like the other sea turtles as well, but just a little bit longer.